It is my immense pleasure to welcome to the stage Ms. Kamla Shamsi. Please join me. Please join me. This is the very first episode of The Literary Conversation, a podcast celebrating 30 years of TLC, where we ask authors big questions about all things literature and storytelling. Our guests will be, as well as Kamla, Damien Barr, Lucia Osborne-Crowley, Tash Orr, Gavin Clifton, and Lem Sisse. Kamla Shamsi is probably known to everybody in this room and everyone listening. She's the author of 10 books, including the novels Burnt Shadows, shortlisted for the Orange Prize, A God in Every Stone, shortlisted for the Women's Prize, and the Walter Scott Prize, and The Extraordinary Home Fire, which won the Women's Prize for Fiction, was also long-listed for the Man Booker, shortlisted for the Costa Best Novel Award, and won the London Hellenic Prize. She's a fellow and vice president of the Royal Society of Literature and was named a grantor Best of Young British Novelists in 2013. And her work has been translated into an astonishing 30 languages. So please, can we have another warm round of applause for Kamla? Thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to start with a snippet of a poem by a Palestinian poet, which will lead into my first question for you. Marwan Markool writes, "In order for me to write poetry that isn't political, I must listen to the birds. And in order to hear the birds, the warplanes must be silent." Now, you've said poets are closer to activists than you are. And yet, so much of your work is inherently, integrally, fundamentally political. Do you consider yourself a political writer? And what is your relationship to that real-life politics, particularly in these fraught times?
One of the interesting things about being a writer in Britain who grew up in Pakistan was this discovery that there's a sort of fraught feeling around this phrase political writer, political novel, which is a writer or a novel. You know, you're contending with the world you live in. And the world you live in is always the context. Whether it's, you know, a context that is breathing down your neck or a context that is allowing you to move freely without having to think about the government, the context is always there. There's a really... This is going to be a silly sentence. There was an interesting moment when COVID happened. But when COVID happened, I remembered wondering whether people would stop feeling so fraught about the political novel, because COVID was the moment, I think, when even people who lived in places and in demographics that didn't have to think about politics should have realized how completely, not completely, but how the extent to which politics defines our lives. The government could say, you will not go to the funeral of someone who you love. You will not go and see someone who is dying in hospital. You will not leave the country in many cases. And that should have been the moment where you realize if you cannot go to the funeral of someone you love is a political decision, then you can go to the funeral of someone you love is also a political decision, in as much as no one is doing anything to stand in the way of you doing that. But we don't think of it in those terms. We think politics happens only when it's breathing down our neck in a terrible way. And I grew up with it breathing down my neck in a terrible way, I suppose, so I was always aware of that. I grew up in a military dictatorship. But I also grew up knowing that that isn't all there is. But my interest in, if I'm going to write about something, I'll say, where am I? And the next question is, when am I? And that when am I is always going to have an effect on where am I? Which is to say, London in the summer of 2026 is quite different to London in the summer of 2015. It's a post-Brexit summer. It's a summer of reform. It's a summer of all kinds of instability. It's a summer of Trump across the water. 2015 felt different. It's a summer where the reality of the climate catastrophe is making us sweat, literally and in other ways. So again, this is a very long-winded way of saying we're always, I think, taking on the moment in which we live. Whether you want to attach the word political to that or not is your choice, but it is, right? Because the contours of where you're living, the things you're allowed to do, the things you're not allowed to do, is always determined or mediated by the big political world in which you're living.
You talk there about situating yourself when you write these books. Where am I? When am I?
Yeah.
How far, if at all, do you wonder about the locus of the reader in that equation? Because, you know, you've talked about the kind of moral imperative that we have to write in this way, to talk in this way, to engage with the world in this way. Where does the reader come into that equation for you when you're writing?
The reader is not my concern. Which I don't mean this in the way of, as a writer, the readers in my concern is in as much as I need to be doing things to make a reader want to turn the page. But I grew up in Karachi reading the English language novel, and no one had me in mind as their reader, and it made not a whit of difference to my engagement with the books and how much I loved them. You know? It would have an effect on how I was reading the books. So I talk about this a lot because our childhood loves stay with us. I loved C.S. Lewis and the Narnia books. At some point, of course, I realized that the villains, particularly in The Horse and the Boy, were dark-skinned and had curved swords and turbans. And there's a moment of, oh. It was a moment of, oh, that didn't stop me loving the things I loved in the book, but it complicated it. But my reading experience was still my reading experience, full of richness and complication. You don't know who's going to come upon your book. I don't write for a specific audience because I love the idea of some version of the young me, you know, someone who the writer had never dreamed of, picking up the book and finding something that is extraordinary and wonderful. I think the wonder of the novel is that, and I'm speaking very specifically as a novelist because that's my form, the wonder of the novel is that it will reward both knowing and unknowing. So some people come to books and they say, you're writing about the world I know about. And I recognize so much, but there are things that I hadn't seen in this way, or had never voiced in this way, and that's wonderful. And other times people will come to the same book and say, you're writing about something I knew nothing about, and it introduced me to a new world. And the novel will let in either if it's working, which then does lift the burden off us as writers to think too much about the readers, because the readers will find it. If we do our work to make the novel the best possible novel, and of course there are people who pick up a book and say, not for me, and that's fine. I'm never offended by the idea that there are people who pick up my book and say, not for me, because there are all kinds of novels in the world that are not for me.
I love the idea of you being unburdened of the labour of educating the reader in that process, and yet the space, as you say, is open should they wish to receive and learn from something that might not be their own lived experience. You've also said in an interview that you write without shortcut, without compromise. And I love that you do that, and yet you still manage to complicate, as you have just mentioned, these relationships, in particular these intimate relationships between key characters. So I've got a little pile of books here by Kamala. And at the top, in fact, is Best of Friends. That might be a great example of a complicated relationship, of a friendship between two women over time. And in fact, across some of these books on here, we have two... a very close relationship complicated over a number of years. What is it that draws you to the intimacy of these relationships, which are often not easy, full of silences, spaces, and betrayals, and yet somehow persist?
I mean, the truth is, when things are easy and uncomplicated, they're not great for fiction. But also, they aren't then things you wish to explore in the same way, because it's the complication, the tension that you have to sort of sit with and figure your way through. And for me, fiction is the way I think best. So if there's something I'm wondering about or worrying at, it'll come out in the fiction. And often I'll set out to write a book and I'll think it's going to be one kind of thing. And then I discover that there is something that I'm worrying away at inside. And in the process of the novel, I'm working away at it. And of course, the relationship of two people is tremendously intimate in a way that is that the novel loves and rewards, I think. But it's there are two people, again, to go back to what I was earlier saying, there are two people in particular spaces, in particular moments, in particular contexts. And so all those things can come in. It becomes a way of talking about anything by talking about how these two individuals are navigating their relationship with the thing, whether it is an idea or a nation or a religion or whatever. So they're navigating their own relationship with it, and then they're navigating someone else's relationship with the same thing in different ways.
And I love how this is often, it's certainly in your stories, often a platonic relationship, because I think we tend to imagine and through the canon we see these highly romanticised relationships. They keep readers turning pages, the will they, won't they. And I'm much more interested, especially in female friendships, explored in fiction. There's not enough of that. A challenge to those of you in the room, perhaps working on your own books. and you do that so beautifully in Best of Friends with Zara and Miriam. And I wonder what your friendships in life have taught you that has crawled its way into your writing.
I think the greatest stroke of luck in my life has been my friendships throughout. And you learn different things, including, you know, let's invoke Becky Smith, Swift. I don't call her Smith, terrible. She'll haunt me. Becky Swift, who's the founder of TLC, who was a very dear friend, and through whom you have to learn what it is to lose a friend. And the way in which they stay with you, which is a sort of miracle, you know. There are certain bits of Hampstead Heath that I'll walk on, and Becky's there. You learn different things through friendships, and one of the things that Best of Friends was interested in was that the childhood friend, which starts before you really have defined personalities. You certainly don't know what you believe. You just know, we played hopscotch together, it was fun, let's do that again tomorrow. Your friends are often your earliest friends. It's why I was interested with Best of Friends and, you know, that idea of childhood friendship. Your earliest friends in life are often the first people who choose you and you choose them. You know, because prior to that, you've been with your family. You're there. You know, they can choose to get on with you or not get on, but they don't choose you. And your friends do. And what I also find so interesting in friendship is the multiplicity. I mean, of course, there can be jealousy and often is within friendships. But also we, I think, recognize, particularly as we grow older, most of us do, that we have different friends for different moments, you know, and that it shifts who matters more or less. I think at a certain point in time, your childhood friends become less important. And I think they become more important again as your parents are aging, because your childhood friends are the ones who probably, you know, saw you growing up and knew who you were when you were your parents' child, aged 8 or 10 or 12 or 14, and what they meant to you when they were at their most powerful in their in your life. I do think it's a remarkable thing, friendship. I remember once being at the Karachi Literature Festival, and I looked out into the audience, and in the front row there was a group of women, and I knew almost all of them, and they were all widows. I think almost all of them had husbands who were a fair bit older and had died. And you saw them, how suddenly it was like schoolgirls again, that they had reverted, but at a very different stage, that, you know, their friends were keeping them going, And I thought that's so interesting, the way you start off and your friends are the most important people, and then here they are 70, 80 years later and their friends are the most important people again, and they're kind of hanging out and keeping each other going.
I love that idea of friends as a kind of homecoming. And you've spoken a lot about home. You deal a lot with home and the kind of expansiveness of home as multiple, as various. And you spoke there about choice, choosing the friends that you have. One thing you don't choose is the family you have. And I think equally in something like Home Fire, you deal with this idea of non-chosen yet essential family. You know, with friends, we share this landscape of childhood. With family, we share these complicated cultural landscapes, dynamics. And in Home Fire, you chose to... I was going to say adapt, but I would like to ask you what that word is. Mm. It is inspired by... pushing against Sophocles, mm-hmm. Antigone specifically. What does that process of adaptation look like to you? Because you've also adapted Hans Christian Andersen, which we can talk about in a moment, hopefully.
So when I first had the idea, or someone presented the idea to me, of a sort of contemporary adaptation of Antigone, one of my first thoughts was, well, I'll let go of anything in the play that isn't useful to the novel. It's always when I'm writing, the one thing that I'm absolutely clear on is you do what the novel needs, even if it's painful sometimes. I mean, there are times when you're writing a novel and you want to sort of make a point that you would like people to know. But if it doesn't work for the novel, you have to throw it out. You can make your point somewhere else. It's always what does the novel need. So I thought, well, whatever this play, Antigone, written 2,500 years ago, whatever is in there that isn't useful to the novel, I'll get rid of. And it was wonderfully liberating to know that Antigone didn't need me. You know, I think it would have been different if I was working, say, with a much lesser known text. And then you sort of feel a sort of responsibility that you're kind of taking something on, and a lot of people will know this text through you and what you're doing with it, and you have to be very careful, and what's your responsibility. I had none of that with Antigone. That play had been around long before me. It was going to be around long after me. There were thousands of adaptations. It was fine. It would survive anything I did. So that was a real sense of liberation. The surprise to me when I actually wrote the novel was how little of it I got rid of, because it sort of was the marrow, and it's so tightly structured, you know, and every piece is knits into every other piece so totally that I was adding things on. But even though it was a 2,500-year-old play, there wasn't a lot I was getting rid of. What I was getting rid of was a lot of people's readings of Antigone, which are often quite misogynist, you know, and wanting to frame these sort of two sisters as which is the good sister and which is the bad sister. The play itself is not asking you necessarily to do that. You know, the play is so open to whatever interpretations you're going to bring to it. So that was the surprise, was how readily it lent itself to being a 21st story of London, how little of it had to actually go away.
And had I not known that it was based on Antigone, you've done just such a masterful job that the framework almost becomes invisible. And yet, like you say, is essential to the book. And I did say that we'd talk about Duckling because I would love to, I don't know if people are aware, I was not aware that you had written, do you see it as a children's book? So Duckling is an adaptation of Hans Christian Andersen. What kind of book is it for you? Because it looks like a children's book. Is that how you had originally imagined it? How did that come about?
I was commissioned to do a retelling of a fairy tale, and it was going to be an illustrated book, and it was... But I think it was always clear that it was going to be for sort of older children, so I didn't have... You know, I could do what I wanted. So I see it as... I mean, it's an interesting question. Do writers see... You know, when you're writing the book, you don't, I think, what is the book? You find the voice. You know, and quite early on I knew what the voice was going to be, and clearly it's not a voice that requires you to have, let's say, the same vocabulary as a 25-year-old, possibly. But once I had the voice, I didn't have to think very much at all about how I was, who I was thinking of it as. It was, I'm retelling a fairy tale, which, and of course fairy tales are, in their origin, were very dark and, you know, not necessarily for children in the way we think now.
Oh, I still have nightmares about the original Grimm's tales as a German child.
Terrifying. Cinderella, the original Grimm's tale, you know, hauntingly horrible.
Dancing to death in white hot shoes, yeah. Those sorts of things. Ghastly.
The sisters, in, we have now, for those who don't know, in Cinderella, the sisters who want the shoe to fit them, one chops off her heel and one chops off her toes to try and get that shoe to fit them. It's magnificent.
Duckling isn't quite as dark Duckling, as this.
No,
so, be thinking
so
of it
wasn't dark
children?
At all. So no, I just thought of it as a story which would have pictures, and isn't that nice? But I don't believe in ever condescending to a reader. And in some way to sort of think, oh, I'm doing this for children. Well, what does that mean? It meant nothing except that children, you know, can take most things you throw at them. You just have to, again, make it compelling enough. And also with Duckling Brazil, what can I do with this very old story to make it new? And of course, Duckling is a... obviously, Duckling, the ugly duckling, is a story of someone in a group who is not like other people in the group. You know, it kind of almost writes itself.
When you do, but you do something really interesting in Duckling, I think. Mm-hmm. Firstly, you don't conform to this must be the voice. It is the voice that it is. Mm-hmm. And then throughout, what I particularly liked, that there is no neatness in the duckling simply becomes beautiful and therefore is acceptable or palatable. And you mentioned throughout the mother duck, for instance, at the beginning, tells a story of a duck that couldn't fly, who became heroic. And then later on, there's the possibility of becoming useful. And actually, the story, even if not the duckling, resists that idea of becoming heroic to be important, becoming useful to be accepted. And I appreciate that.
I think it also, at the end, resists the idea that all you have to do is find other people who look like you, and then it'll be okay. That actually being with a whole bunch of other people who all look different, that's quite miraculous, and the beginning of some beautiful friendships, to go back to friendship.
I mean, this is a really left-field question that I haven't prepared you for. I wonder if you could, because this is a TLC event, and Becky is very much in my mind anyway, what do you think of your books might have been her favourite?
I think she would have liked Best of Friends. Also because Best of Friends involves women walking in Hampstead Heath.
Which she did daily.
And which I did a lot with Becky. So I think she'd probably been quite critical as well and said, well, you should have mentioned, you know, she'd have pointed out things that I could have mentioned that were sort of key to Hampstead Heath and its interactions. But yeah, I think she'd have liked that one.
Good choice. Yeah. And another thing that I think is absolutely beautiful in a lot of the work that you write is this idea that keeps coming up of stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves and who we are, and these kind of micro-betrayals that we've already mentioned in our conversation. And there's this quote from Home Fire where I think it's Dr. Shah is saying, the fabric... and an untold story are the only obstacles between you and him, talking about the gaps between Isma and Eamon. Mm. Are you consciously exploring these gaps? Because it just, maybe this is me projecting, but as a reader, I feel I find these spaces through your work that you are breaking open, and it leaves a lot of space for me. Mm. And I just wonder how far that's a narrative choice or just an incidental part of the writing process.
And I'm so interested in the way that we're always building narratives and counter-narratives, and they're leaving things out and they're cherry-picking. I mean, you know, nations do it as well. There are attempts now to build a story of Britain that would exclude many of us in the room, and perhaps by sensibility would exclude all of us in the room. You know, and you can see there's a cherry-picking and distortions of... We were this before. No, you weren't. You know, we were this before. You weren't. We could be it again. Maybe there's something better you could be again. And so I'm always interested in the way we're constructing story, and we're constructing stories of ourselves as well. Human beings, I think our brain works towards storytelling, and it's absolutely necessary because the world is total chaos and terror, let's face it. And that there isn't necessarily one line that we can all agree on, one line of logic, of story that pulls us through it. And so we find our own. But what happens is the stories that start mattering to you, the stories that you're gathering evidence for, that's really important. And other people are gathering evidence for different kinds of stories. And there's evidence for all kinds of stories because it is chaos. But what would our brains do if we couldn't form stories? If all we saw was disconnection and randomness and chaos, it would be terrible. You know, sometimes people say things like, well, do you worry you'll run out of stories to write? I mean, one day I might stop writing for some reason. It could happen. It happens to people. But that narrative ability, that story-making ability, I think is so deep in every human being that the wonder is the people who forget it, and some do. But it's in all of us, and it's very helpful when you're writing to remember that. You know, you're writing a story, and then you sort of get stuck. You don't know what's going to happen next, and it's very easy to start feeling panic. I don't know what's going to happen next. And there is a great reassurance in remembering that your brain knows how to do this. The human brain, among the things evolution has taught us, is how to build stories. Don't panic. You'll find it. You may have to go back a little and say, actually, the last two steps didn't really work. Let's go back and find the story from a slightly earlier moment. Or, yes, there are seven different stories that could occur at this point. Don't panic. It doesn't mean you're doing something wrong. There are always seven different stories, at least, that could occur from any given moment. You know, it's a really interesting thing about us. We are storytelling animals.
What's the story you tell yourself to keep writing?
This is how I pay the bills. That's helpful. Let's not ever underestimate that one. I've been doing it so long that it's become a habit of my brain. You know, and when I'm not writing, it can be wonderful for time. There's a sort of, okay, I can just do whatever. But there always comes a point where I almost feel that I can hear my brain rattling in my skull, because this thing that I use my brain for and have for so long, I'm not using it. And it just feels wrong. But I always think of a line that my friend, the great writer Gillian Slover, once said. She said, when I'm writing and it's going well, I'm at home in a particular way that I love. And, you know, we talk, there's always a lot of talk about how hard writing is, things are hard. If you're challenging yourself, it's going to be hard. And if you're not challenging yourself, that's a bit of a waste. But I think we often don't spend enough time talking about, you know, that moment when you say, I did this and it's good. I was very lucky when I was at university in America. I had this wonderful poet as a teacher. He was a Kashmiri poet called Agha Shahid Ali. And he was a really fantastic and exacting poet. You know, every syllable mattered. And I learned many things from him. But one of his most extraordinary gifts to me, I think, and it took me a long time to realize it was a gift because I didn't realize how rare it was, Shahid had extraordinary generosity to everyone, including himself. And that including himself was so important to be around. When he wrote a good line, he would be lit up by it. You know, he would work and work and work and work and work and work to get the good line. You know, he wouldn't allow himself anything less than the best he could do and a little more. But when he got there, he'd be very pleased. And he'd say, look what I did. if he cooked a brilliant meal, which he did, and you'd say, this is amazing, he'd say, I know, isn't it? That wasn't ego. It was just, it's wonderful to do something well, to have the day when the good sentence came. Acknowledge it. I have no idea what question you asked. It's possibly anywhere.
No, we're going with it. We're flowing with it. But the generosity as a gift to oneself, that really struck a chord with me. We think of it, giving to other people, that's the more common iteration or definition of that. And earlier you were saying, you know, you pick the stories that matter at different points in your life, different geopolitical climates, because these often you're taking particular events in history for your books. And speaking of gifts and thinking of stories that matter, I wonder what the biggest gift you either have been given or have given yourself is, that is part of your literary self.
I get to be a writer.
That's who gave you that? Do you see that as something you've given yourself? Where's that come from?
It's a mix of all kinds of things. It's luck plays a role. Luck always plays a role. I think I used to always say, I just got really lucky. And then at a certain point I realized you have to stop saying that, because there is also the absolute determination and the sitting down day after day and doing the work. So I guess it's seizing the luck. Not even making it, but seeing that there is some opening and some possibility. Increasingly, I think the gift is, I used to think, to have a first novel out. That's the thing. And it is, something amazing to have the first novel out. And now I think, and Bernadine's at the back, and Bernie, I think you'll possibly feel this way as well. The great thing is that we're still doing this. All this while later. My first book came out 28 years ago, 1998. There are so many writers who were starting off at the same time as me who were amazing writers. And I look around and a lot of them aren't there anymore for one reason or the other. They stop writing, something else happened, or they're still writing but they're finding it harder to get published, or they're finding it harder to earn any kind of living off it. So to me, the gift is 28 years on. Almost as long. I've been published writing almost as long as TLC has been doing its thing.
I know. Yeah. Oh, we've got you beat by 2 years. Yeah. But I think that's a really good point, talking about sustainability of a writing career, and that it is significantly harder now. Mm. And actually, that is a big reason we exist, and why Becky set us up, and why we're still here. We're still here 30 years later. That it's important. It's more important to us to look at how to keep writers writing than it is for us to cherry pick the best stories from the best clients. We've always said that. We will always stand by that, because the best writers are those that persist, and they need frameworks and support through kinship, through fellowship, friendship, but also professional networks and development and so on. So that is, it feels really important. Before I ask you our final roundup questions, which I'm going to ask you about three book recommendations. Yes. But I would, I feel it'd be remiss of me not to look into the future and do a bit of horizon scanning. Mm. Given that we are in a state of surveillance, disinformation, climate injustice, political turmoil, strange things happening through the world, when we talk about the stories that matter and the future of literature and storytelling, what matters to you as we think about the writers of now looking into and writing into the future? What matters most to you?
What matters most to me? It's different things on different given days. My angst is about humanity, where writers feel, I don't mean small in a dismissive way, but there is a sense, of, I can't see 20 years from now. I have no idea what it's going to look like. And it's a combination of the political moment we're in, but that less so, because in the past, there have been lots of political moments which have been, you know, fraught. I remember when Doris Lessing won the Nobel, and there was an interview with her, and she was asked about the world and how she feels about the world now. And this was, you know, the war on terror years. And she said, well, when I was growing up, there was Hitler, there was Stalin, there was apartheid in South Africa, there's not much better in America, there was Mussolini, you know, and those things have gone. Of course, now we can say, well, they're kind of coming back. But, you know, in that moment, but I can see my way through political cycles. The climate catastrophe, I don't know how to see my way through. I also don't know what AI is going to do to writers and how we write and what that'll mean. There's a part of me that's intrigued. You know, I'm not only sort of Luddite terror, shut it off. I think there's something quite interesting. And I also think that, you know, I write differently now to the way I did, or to the way someone did 30 years ago, because of even pre-AI, Google is changing, you know, things. That we change as writers, and AI, of course, it's not to say that AI is the same as Google coming along. There are all kinds of terrors attached to it. I don't know. You know, and the state of unknowing is very, very hard. But fortunately, the state of unknowing is something, again, it's quite productive. Because when you come to unknowing as a writer, you think, oh, I don't know, let's sit and write about it. And so I feel very grateful. I think writers in some way are lucky because we have a space to put unknowing and see it as somewhere that creativity can come from. And most people just have unknowing and terror. So at least we're working with unknowing all the time. What's the next sentence? I don't know. What are these characters going to do? I have no idea. But I do feel very frightened a lot of the time. And then writing becomes very useful because one thing that writing does is it makes you, if you're sitting down to write, and if you're sitting down to read, I think, your brain moves into a different space. You can't write in a state of total despair. I mean, you may feel despair, and then you sit down to write, and then you start playing with words, and something else happens in your brain. And I think it's really necessary to keep our brains trained to do that something else, to work with unknowing, to make something creative of it, to look deeper into it and imagine the different scenarios. Again, not directly answering your question because I don't have the direct, you know, it just, there's so much now, it just feels incredibly fraught. But again, when I'm writing, is in some ways the least fraught I feel because I think, yeah, chaos. And then you bring the chaos into words and something else happens.
The febrile unknown.
Febrile unknown.
Making space for hope and making sense of chaos. That is the title of this podcast.
There we go.
Retroactively. Camilla, thank you so much for your time. Our final question before we finish this podcast here at the 30th anniversary at Lumiere London. Thank you, our wonderful hosts. Will be your book recommendations. We're asking all six of our guests this question. A book that changed your life, a book that changed the world, and a book that you've not read yet but you'd like to, perhaps because it doesn't exist.
The book that changed my... Look, I'm sorry I'm going to do this, but the fact is no book has changed my life more than my own first published novel, because it's when I went from not having a novel published to having a novel published. It kind of slightly changes how you feel at a molecular level, I think. You know, you go from, well, you know, what do you, well, I'm trying to, well, I want to, well, I'm working on this thing, but I don't know, to, I've written a novel, it's coming out, this is its name. I was sickeningly young when it happened. And I remember very clearly, am I allowed to give the extended answer to
this?
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was doing my MFA, so I was still a student. It was the 10th of December, 1997. I was peeling a potato, and the phone rang. I was going to make lunch. I was a very bad cook then. I have no idea what I was going to do with this potato. And the phone rang. It was my... I was in Massachusetts. It was my agent in London. And she said, Granter wants to publish your book. And then she said, it's not a lot of money. And I said, I'll pay them. And then I put the phone down and I remembered in this, you know, you want something large to happen in that moment, but I'm in the studio apartment with this potato, like Yorick skull. And I had this very grand moment. I thought, this potato belonged to the life I had before I knew I was going to be a published novelist. And I threw away that half-peeled potato. I feel terrible. It was an awful waste of a potato. But there was just this desire to, like, mark in some way the thing that something elemental felt like it had shifted. So the poor potato got sacrificed.
Sacrificial potato. That was the book that changed your life. A book that changed the world. And then the book that you haven't read yet.
The book that changed the world... I mean... There are several. I think The Feminine Mystique was probably one of them, you know. Even though I haven't read it, which is funny, but I also haven't read The Origin of Species.
I haven't read that. I have read.
But again, it's these books that you know they've changed the world because you don't have to have read them to feel very deeply that the world you're living in is different because of them, you know. But I also was... I did think, God, I should choose a novel. And I realised it can't be a novel. It cannot ever be a novel. For a good reason, which is that a novel leaves such space for interpretation. And people can come into it and read it in completely different ways. It's not a polemic. It's not going to insist. It might try and coax. It might even try and seduce. But it's not going to insist that you have to read me this way. You have to take away these beliefs and ideas from it. So it won't ever be a novel, and I think that's fine.
Perfect. Yeah. And our very, very last, the book that you've not read yet that you would like to. It doesn't have to exist. Perhaps it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
A provocation.
No, it doesn't exist because I have often thought about this book, and it is a novel. I grew up in Pakistan. My family at partition in 1947 was divided. Some stayed in India. Some of us came to Pakistan. And there are a lot of novelists out of India. There are a lot of novelists out of Pakistan. The novel that doesn't exist, I don't know when it will or what it would take, is the novel of that is equally of both sides of the family now. I couldn't write it. Because I would know that Pakistani side so much better and so much intimately, there would be a sort of weird disbalance. It's not to say you can't write about things you don't know, but if there's a disbalance between two parts of your novel and your sense of connection to it, it's going to become a problem. But I would love that novel of, you know, sort of over three generations between the grandparents who grew up together in pre-partition India and had the same experiences to grandchildren or grandchildren or great-grandchildren who literally are not allowed because of visa rules to cross the border and see how the others live. And that's the kind of thing fiction should be doing, actually, saying, okay, we can't cross the border in life. Let's do it in fiction. I don't know, maybe one day I'll be a person who can do it. I'm not now, and I would love it. Anyone here, volunteers?
Well, I was about to say, if anyone listening thinks, this sounds like something that's inside of me, please, you can then later when you win your prizes say, the award-winning Kamla Shamsi inspired me to write this book. This has been the Literary Conversation with Kamla Shamsi, and I would just like to take a moment to thank her for her presence, her candour, her generosity, her insights, her expertise, and most of all, her writing.